The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, almost qualified, the nations battling to reach the World Cup. Barely qualified, Stevie G and Lamps preparing to take over at Villa and Norwich. We get the latest on all of that, from the road to Qatar to Carrow Road. Plus, the greatest football team in the world, and now is the winter of this content, the boom in football behind-the-scenes docos, and what it all means. All of that in this Totally Football Show, in association with Paddy Power. Thursday the 11th of November, a listener, and yes, we're up extra early for this international break show because we're excited, and we've assembled an all-star cast for it as well. Top people, live from his Manhattan loft, it's the New York Times' Rory Smith.
West Yorkshire more than Manhattan, but apart from that, hello.
Shush, Rory. Yep. Live from Belfast, it's the European football editor of the Daily Mirror, Colin Miller.
Hello, James.
Hello to you, and live from an unspecified area of West London, it's The Athletic's James Horncastle.
Hello.
All right. Is that generic enough for you, James?
Yes, that's fine by me.
Good.
I'll take that.
All right. Listen, thanks so much for being with us today. Question one, how come you guys aren't off on holiday like everyone else we tried?
I was trying, and then I got a WhatsApp, and, you know,
and here
these
you
WhatsApps
are
hard to turn down. So.
Boy, I'll say. All right, well, it is International Week, obviously, which means a different rhythm, I think, for many of us, and certainly to the football. Before we get on to the qualifiers, because they are absolutely huge and, in so many cases, decisive this weekend, let's just get a few last gasps of Premier League oxygen, if you will, before we dive into the whirling waters of the International Weekend. First off, a bit of injury news, a couple of big stories. Angelo Ogbonna. Some fears he may miss the rest of the season for West Ham after damaging his cruciate knee ligaments in West Ham's win over Liverpool on Sunday. Also, potentially having played his last for Manchester United, Paul Pogba. Out until the new year with a hamstring injury picked up in training with France, they say. Is that a real story, or is it just one that plays well with fan sentiment algorithms?
No, that's true. But played his last makes it sound like he's leaving in January, which isn't true.
Good to slam those reports.
It's interesting and unlikely that Ogbonna is a bigger loss to West Ham in the chase for a Champions League place than Paul Pogba is to Manchester United. That seems a weird thing to say, but I think it's probably true, isn't it?
Well, Ogbonna has been such a key part of West Ham's sort of attack and set piece threat as well. And we've spoken about how important that's been for David Moyes. And I think the partnership he's formed with Kurt Zouma has been so impressive. And you look at the other options West Ham have, and you've only really got Craig Dawson, who's well into his 30s. You kind of think, is he going to be able to cope with two or three matches a week over the winter months? And yeah, the guy he's a Diop as well, who seems to have fallen out of favour. But it's West Ham's squad, isn't it? And with their sort of Europa League demands, and they're going far in the League Cup as well, you kind of think that one or two injuries could really prove a big setback. Whereas you look at Man United, and you could feasibly replace Paul Pogba with Donny van de Beek. And I kind of wonder if this Pogba injury will open up the opportunity for Van de Beek, especially with the position that Solskjaer has found himself in. And I think on Saturday against City, you kind of heard a little bit of fan discontent around the Van de Beek situation, so it could pressurise that.
I mean, it should, but it won't, will it? Just for some reason, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer really doesn't want Donny van de Beek to play football at any point. That seems to be...
Unless, Rory, it's not Ole Gunnar Solskjaer making the decision, because I don't know if you saw Ole losing the red wall, as it were, with Rio coming out for the time to go camp. The reports now that it's a question of when, not if, with Brendan Rodgers being lined up to take over.
I found the way that Ferdinand announced his position really odd. It was a bit like when the president of the CBI, or like a major union, used to come out and declare who they were supporting in like a Tory or Labour election. As though it was branded with his five logo, wasn't it? It was kind of finally Rio delivers Oli verdict. When really it's just a bloke saying some stuff about another bloke. Right. That's all it is. There's not actually, like, Rio Ferdinand doesn't have any kind of core voting power on the on the situation. I thought I think the way
pot calling the kettle black though, Rory.
Very much so. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, but I don't trail my pronouncements with finally Rory Smith delivers verdict. The although actually, having said that,
do you
now
not?
That, now that I say it, I don't know why I don't. I should do that. That would make sense. No, I think that it's interesting how the whole Solskjaer discussion has become about his former teammates and their opinions of him, when really that's, I mean, at best tangential to the whole conversation, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
I think it's, I think we've reached a new, we've broken through our own wall here, because I think we have a debate amongst ourselves about how to promote our own content. And some of it is, you know, sort of how many emojis do we use? And maybe this kind of proclamation is the way to get the attention, because it clearly has. But is it just bloke speaking about bloke when basically it feels like United do everything that Rio says? You know, he was the one who said sign the thing and they signed the thing. He was the one who said sign Cristiano Ronaldo and, you know, put his video on Twitter, nodding with, you know, knowingly. So, you know, I'm not going to say that that they act on everything that Rio says and thinks, but they seem sensitive to it, you could say.
I think that's a wider trend for English football, though, that these sort of former players who've gone into punditry and they obviously go on to say things on TV, and there's a lot of weight given to what they say in terms of how it's played out over social media and over various websites and how they report on it as well. And I don't think that's really quite the same as it would be in, say, Italy or Spain or France. I think the weight of what they say is important. And I think as well with how these football clubs operate, and especially Manchester United, we know that they pay so much attention to what people are saying, what people are discussing. And it's almost like people are now discussing what the pundits are discussing, what Gary Neville will or won't say, or what Rio Ferdinand's position is. So I think these statements do carry more weight than they would have done in the past, or they do elsewhere at the moment.
Possibly because you've got groups of owners who are essentially dislocated from the fan base, you know, geographically or just by sheer dint of the fact that they have absolutely no connection socially with them. And therefore, these kind of figureheads act as a useful kind of touchstone for them, or at least they feel that they do.
It's interesting. I remember when I first started as a football journalist for The Mirror, I was really surprised to go to like night games particularly, and you'd see journalists with dictaphones then. Dictaphones, for younger listeners, were like a little thing that looked a bit like a phone, but you couldn't make calls or go on the internet on it. But you could, it was like the voice memo app, but in a piece of actual hardware. And they'd hold them up to the TV for the post-match quotes, and that would be the first edition quotes would be, you know, Roy Keane, or it wouldn't have been Keane then, I suppose, but Souness or whoever says this, Alan Hansen says this, about whatever game had just happened. And it was a piece of journalistic necessity, because you had a 9:30 or a 10 o'clock deadline, so you had to have something on the back page from a big game. I think what Colin's talking about is absolutely right, that we do place a lot of weight on what pundits say, but I think a lot of that comes from the fact that the pundits, they were on before the press conferences traditionally, so it was an easy way to get basically holding copy. And for some reason that tradition has maintained itself, even though we now have the internet and we don't really need these external sort of provocations from the telly. I mean, it's content being created from content, it's meta content, and that is odd that we, you know, a lot of the time these aren't, James might be right with Rio, that he does seem to carry a bit of weight with Manchester United, but a lot of the time they're irrelevances and distractions from the actual core of what's happened, but they do really set the agenda. But I think that's less to do with how important or insightful those comments are, and more to do with the convention that journalists would record those quotes and put them in their newspapers to fill a hole until something actually interesting happened.
I mean, it is a cultural thing. In if you look at US sports, the access, not just to players and managers, but to just executives, public-facing executives, is just non-existent in the Premier League, where in Italy and in Spain, you would have a sporting director come out and speak before every game, and you'd be able to pose questions to them. And most of the time, they would lie. You know, Andrea Pirlo has got a 3-year contract at Juventus. He will be our manager for as long as possible, blah, blah, blah. And we just don't have that. So again, that gives disproportionate importance to basically pundits, you know, whoever, when it comes to making these various proclamations, and yeah, they become part of the contents thing that we all then react on, which we are doing now.
Mm, content from content from content. Colin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the TV coverage knows what it's doing with this as well. Especially Sky Sports have become the masters of this for 3 decades, and it's why the Premier League now has so much more money because of how the league's marketed itself. But the TV companies know that it's almost like what happens in the studio has become as important as what happens on the pitch. And even in Saturday's game, United against City, it was largely a non-event, yet you had fantastic entertainment from Roy Keane, from Graham Souness, from Micah Richards as well, and even the Monday Night Football with Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher, and the depth that they go into is fantastic, but people are really attracted to that sort of thing. And so I think it's a combination of all these factors, and it's fed into the culture that's made the Premier League what it is.
It's the Paddy Power Football Supporters Support Line, and we're speaking to Kevin in Dagenham. Kevin, what's your issue, mate?
It's the hardware stores, isn't it? They're all out of white emulsion.
Sorry, Kevin, what's that got to do with football, pal?
Well, it's international break, mate, and I'd rather watch paint dry.
You can make the international break that bit more exciting with Paddy Power's Bet Builder. Get money back as a free bet if one leg of your Bet Builder lets you down. Paddy Power! Pretty much online bet builders with min 2 legs only. Max 1 free £5 bet per customer. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
It does look like the Premier League is going to have a very different look when it gets back together, because, of course, 2 new managers are coming in. Fans of Naughty's overlapping midfield roles type humour, or all of us essentially, will be excited that those 2 managers look like being Steven Gerrard, who's interested apparently in the vacant Villa job, while Frank Lampard in talks to take over at Norwich. Crikey. Hands up who's excited. My hand's up, listener. You can't see it, but it is. And nobody else. But I'm excited for all of us. Gerrard, what is it with Villa testing our cognitive dissonance? First they bring in JT, Chelsea legend, and paint him in Villa colours. And now they're going to do it to cut him and he bleeds cop Steven Gerrard.
Well, there's a little bit of Liverpool at Villa, isn't there? There's Christian Preslow is the chief executive, who was there for a lot of Gerrard's time at Anfield. Supposedly get on very well, very fond of, I think Preslow is very fond of Gerrard. And so, yeah, there's someone advocating for that there, even though they have a sporting director of their own who might have candidates of his own. Okay, it's a curious one. I think we'll probably get into, you know, whether he should stick or twist with the job that he's got at the moment. But you can see why he's clearly come up at Villa.
I mean, it looks like the latest reports, this is Wednesday night as we record it, it looks like it's going to happen.
Yeah, it does. And I think from Gerrard's perspective, it makes sense. It looks a little like he might have... He's accomplished what he went to Scotland to do. I think that's probably fair to say. He stopped Celtic winning 10 in a row. He's got Rangers' 55th title. Which order of importance those are to Rangers fans is very much up to the Rangers fans. But he's turned Rangers back into a force in Scotland. And that was what he set out to do. And I think because of the financial limitations at Rangers in particular and in Scottish football as a whole, that he probably will be looking at that and thinking it won't ever get as good again. Realistically, that there's a reasonable chance, greater than 50-50, that they'll win the title this season just because of Celtic's start. They've done well in Europe, but they're not gonna win the Europa League. That's not gonna happen for Rangers. So from Gerrard's point of view, I can see why he thinks this might be the time to jump. I think from Villa's point of view, it's much more of a risk, because still not entirely clear to me, admittedly someone who's not watched Rangers every week, what sort of coach Gerrard's going to be. I think he's more likely to see himself as a manager, whereas as as James has mentioned, Villa do have a sporting director system, and they've got a lot of kind of data usage in the background. There's quite a smart setup overall at Villa, I think. Dean Smith was happy within that structure. I don't know how Gerrard will feel about it. It may be that he's totally okay with it, and that's fine. It may be that he wants things to work a bit differently, and that can cause problems. So I think it makes sense from Gerrard's point of view, if you assume that Steven Gerrard's ultimate ambition is to manage Liverpool, which I think is probably fair right. enough. Villa do make sense as a, and it's strange to say it, as a, you know, former champion of Europe, you know, one of the biggest six clubs in England historically. Villa do make sense at this point as a bit of a stepping stone into one of those true elite jobs. But from Villa's point of view, I'm not sure he'd be the candidate I'd go for. But then I'm not sure I'd have sacked Dean Smith, so maybe I'm not the best judge.
All right. Do you know what happens on the 11th of December?
I'm guessing that Villa goes to Anfield.
That's correct, Rory. Woof. You got a nose for narrative. Colin?
I actually disagree with Rory on this. I think this is a bigger risk for Gerrard than it is for Villa. I think that, yes, Steven Gerrard's gone and he's won a league title. He ended that Celtic period of dominance. But as things stand at the minute, Rangers are the best team in Scotland. Celtic are still in somewhat of a transitional phase. And he's got the opportunity to go on and win more trophies at the moment and to build somewhat of a dynasty. I mean, I don't know if that's maybe overstating things a little bit, but I've been really impressed with how he's handled himself at Rangers, and not just in terms of the domestic success, which you could argue is partly down to what's happened across the city, but how Rangers have performed in Europe has really shown Gerrard and his coaching staff, who I believe are going to be going with him to Villa, according to the reports, that these are sort of modern, progressive style of coaching and a way of playing, and that's something that stood out for me, that Rangers' success in Europe. I think they were the first Scottish team in over a decade to win a knockout match in Europe after the group stages. So his achievements have been good. He's obviously a very young manager. He's got a lot to learn. But I think Villa as a club are more of a risk at the minute, in the sense that they've only got 10 points from their opening 11 matches. And obviously the sale of Grealish in the summer. Their 14 matches in the Premier League last year without Grealish only got 13 points. So they're averaging less than a point a game without him in the team. And yes, they are an ambitious club who have invested heavily and quite well, in my opinion. But if Gerrard makes a mistake at Rangers, and I think they've maybe slightly regressed this season, but that isn't really picked up upon so much within, let's say, the Liverpool fan base. But if you're in the Premier League and you're struggling, especially for a club of Villa's stature, those little mistakes will get amplified more. So I think this is a risk for him, in the sense that the timing of it, it's probably earlier than he expected and would have been ideal for him to have. But I think it's a really interesting appointment, and I'd be interested to see just what he can do with this Aston Villa team. I think there's a lot of potential there.
I just wonder what he can achieve with Villa, because, you know, it's one thing to be at Rangers, potentially retaining your title, winning a trophy, as Colin was saying, making your knockout stages of a European competition again, where that's where they've caught my eye for 3 years, you know, sort of topping a group that had Benfica in it, you know, Benfica more often than not in the Champions League rather than the Europa League, going undefeated in both games against them. I've been generally impressed. They were unlucky not to make the Champions League group stages. They were better than Malmo, ultimately. So I think in some respects, there's more opportunity to keep catching the eye at Rangers because he's Steven Gerrard and Rangers. Yeah, so you've got a massive person, massive club that will make headlines and will still be talked about. At Villa, I think everyone says it's a really good job. And I do think it's one of the better jobs out there in terms of history and tradition, in terms of resources. And even in the squad, you know, as much as Grealish has gone, I do think there are signings that more can come from them. But yeah, what's going to be success for Steven Gerrard at Aston Villa? Is it a cup run? Is it not getting relegated? I think there's more risk to just be much of a muchness being at Villa rather than staying at Rangers, because ultimately, when the Liverpool job comes up, He will be in the frame. I would
think. Do you think straight from Rangers without another job under his belt?
Well, yeah, I think even with very sensible owners, analytics based, I think they will still be guided by what fans think, because ultimately that's why they pulled out the Super League. And we see it all the time, even at big clubs who've had great success, who've made good decisions to get to sort of preeminent dominant positions. They do make these decisions ultimately. So, you know, I question why Barcelona have gone for Xavi, from Al Sadd. Not enough kind of what he represents, idea, how well he articulates his ideas, blah blah blah. But at the same time, I don't really understand what Xavi has done at Al Sadd, which is less than what, say, Steven Gerrard has done at Rangers.
I mean, James, have you not seen that move that they put together that was on Twitter? That why Xavi's got the job. I mean, what more do you want? I think that's a really good point that James makes, and Colin too, that the problem Gerrard's got, I'm not convinced Liverpool would give him the job straight from Rangers. I think they might think that's too much of a leap. I think Gerrard's thinking is to an extent that he would need another job in between to be able to do the Liverpool job well, not just to get it, but to be able to do it well. But the problem he's got is that kind of top four, top six, to an extent, don't really see themselves as being related to everybody else in the Premier League. That, you know, they hire from Borussia Dortmund or from one of the other European giants, or they take Antonio Conte, who's just left Inter or whatever. They don't look at kind of managers who've done well with mid-table sides, taking someone from 14th to 7th, and think that is adequate preparation. So I think the issue for Gerrard, more than anything, is what does he need to do at Villa to get the Liverpool job, or to convince Liverpool's owners that he is now ready for the Liverpool job? Because that success for Villa is a cup run, or avoiding relegation, or finishing ninth. That is probably success for Villa at this point. That isn't the sort of success that is going to make Liverpool's owners think, okay, he is now ready. And I'm not actually sure there is a form of success available to Aston Villa manager, whoever it is, that would be looked at by any of the top four as adequate preparation.
Frank Lampard, advanced talks, I'm hearing. That's my information.
There's your sources, Chelsea. James.
Wow. Please. Let me just open the tab. Anyway, so the former Chelsea boss to take over at Carrow Road. It's got a little bit lost, but he had a really good full season in charge of Chelsea, taking them to fourth, reaching an FA Cup final. Is this a good fit, everyone?
I'd be inclined to say yes. I think it's a difficult situation for him because of where they are in the league, but it feels like it's kind of where he needs to be at this stage in his managerial development. I'm not sure you can draw any particularly strong conclusions from what happened at Chelsea.
Right. Other than, is it a bit of a hospital pass, though, in terms of an appointment, Rory, with the record they're on and the squad they've got? And
not the squad's not great, but you have January, and there are talented players there. It would have been much more of a hospital pass had Daniel Farker not beaten Brentford in his last game. I think that just gives a glimmer of being salvageable. But yeah, it's a really difficult job. But by the same token, he's at a club that has proven it will not sack him if they get relegated. It will give him chance to build again in the Championship. So from that point, this season, yes, it's a bit of a hospital pass. Longer term, I'm not sure it is.
The Norwich situation is so interesting, though, in the sense that right now, as how we view it, any manager who comes in, and even if they go down with how the situation is at the moment, you're like, well, that's not really on them. You know, they're inheriting a squad that probably isn't quite good enough for the Premier League. It's a very difficult situation, but no manager will want that on their CV. It's the same with players. It'll be difficult to attract managers. It'll be difficult to attract players in this situation, and you don't want to be in that battle. And the thing for Lampard as well is that, right, if Norwich do go down, there's going to be so much pressure and expectation that they will be promoted automatically the next season, because that is what they've done in their past 2 years in the Championship. And listen, Norwich are obviously a club who are very sensibly run, I think. I think they're probably a model for those clubs that sort of are the yo-yo between the top flight and the Championship, and that they never really commit to spending, and they're loyal to their staff. But it's a difficult one for a manager in terms of, I think you need to have a lot of self-belief that you can get this right and you can buy in to a longer-term project. And I think you're right in the sense that maybe we have forgotten that Frank Lampard, I don't think he did a great job at Chelsea, but I don't think he did a terrible one either. I think it's just, it was quite obvious, certainly in the second season, that the expectations of what the club wanted and what they'd invested was maybe a little bit beyond him. But for a longer term project, which maybe Norwich could offer, it's something that where he could maybe build his own team and really set his sort of football and methods and principles within that. I think it could be a good fit for him in that sense.
All right. As I mentioned, the Premier League will have a very fresh look when things get going again, because also Eddie Howe is now confirmed at Newcastle. One little twist to this this week is the fact that he may be joined there by the sporting director of Liverpool, Michael Edwards, who announced that he was, quote, packing up his laptop. Beyond wherever he ends up, Michael Edwards, how big a loss is this to Liverpool, given that he's the guy credited with finding Salah, Van Dijk, Alisson, Mane and many others?
I think it would be a big surprise for him to go to a club like Newcastle, I think, from what I've heard. And I believe that his next decision would be unorthodox. I don't think setting up a club like Newcastle with the wealth that they have really appeals to him. I might be wrong. So there's that. In terms of his impact at Liverpool, Rory's written about this, about how ingrained and how they've really kind of bet on the importance of analytics and their kind of recruitment model at that club. I think the manager is a massive part of it as well, though. And it will be very interesting to see, because we've seen Klopp do this at Dortmund, at other clubs, where he has made a club greater than the sum of its parts. And it's very interesting to then see those other parts move and analyse and assess what they do elsewhere. Because it's true that, for example, Salah has gone to another level. But I think we all knew Salah was a very good player. We just didn't know that Klopp could get this out of him. Same with Alisson, same with Van Dijk. Yeah, there are other signings that I would look at and think, wow, that's even more impressive. Andy Robertson, for example, things like that. But it is interesting when these structures break apart and you get to see what the various components do next, and then you can kind of make an even better assessment of what they brought.
I think losing Edwards is a blow. I think he's had a massive kind of personal impact on the way that Liverpool work. He's a big figure in everything they've done, not just in recruitment, but kind of in the structures they've put in place in the club. He's not been alone in that, but I think he is a big part of it, and it would be disingenuous to pretend otherwise. Losing him is a blow to Liverpool. I agree with James. I'm not convinced that he will go to a club. I think he might do something different whenever he chooses his next step. The counterbalance to that is that Liverpool have always been really clear that there's loads of different people involved in their recruitment process, particularly that it's not just Edwards, Klopp and Mike Gordon, who I think is the president. I think that might be his title. There's a whole data team. There's Barry Hunter and Dave Fallows, the scouts. There's lots and lots of different people inputting different bits of information, as there should be. And Edwards was in charge of corralling that and influencing, I guess, which bits of that were given greater weight. That was his judgment, and that's the bit they've lost. But all of the other stuff remains in place. The system doesn't fall apart because Edwards is there. He is not kind of the guru as like Graham Carr was at Newcastle or Steve Walsh at Leicester, where once they go or once their contacts book stops producing, that everything falls apart. That's not what is in place at Liverpool. So I'm not convinced that him going means Liverpool will immediately start being dreadful in the transfer market. And equally, I'm not necessarily convinced that if he went to another club, he would immediately be able to replicate what he'd done at Liverpool. I'm sure he'd have a good go in time, because he's clearly very talented. But the system and the structure is what has allowed Liverpool to succeed. It's not just the specific identities of the people behind the scenes.
And it's really interesting as well that Liverpool's sort of transfer business over the past 7 or 8 years has been heralded as how a big club or an elite club should be run. And if we sort of cast our minds back to the discussion about the sort of transfer committee, this was a topic that was always controversial, and I think it was something that a lot of managers and even head coaches didn't particularly like, because there were so many voices in terms of recruitment, and there were so many different angles coming at this, and there wasn't really a clear consensus in what the club should do. And I remember as well that Jurgen Klopp wasn't entirely convinced in this either, and I know that there were reports that Klopp and Edwards sometimes were at odds with which players to sign, and one of those was infamously Salah in the summer of 2017, and Klopp says, look, you know, I would rather get Julian Brandt from Bayer Leverkusen at the time, and Edwards is like, no, you need to look at Salah's underlying numbers and what he's done, and the fact that he had that time at Chelsea, which almost devalued him, certainly in the eyes of English clubs. And this was something that behind the scenes they knew Salah's personality and his drive to become what we now know him as. So that was a really significant moment, and I think sort of from that moment onwards, Klopp certainly became a lot more trusting of the team behind it all and what they were coming up with. So Edwards has played such a key role in all of this, and we talk always about the signings, which have been largely magnificent, but you look at Liverpool's sales and the amount of money and transfer fees they've risen from players who were barely even squad players, and they've come through and they're selling for £10 or £15 million each. And of course the Coutinho sale to Barcelona was well in excess of £100 million, and those deals essentially funded the signings of Van Dijk, of Fabinho, of Alisson, of Salah. And like, I think it's that sort of, it was that business model combined with the analytical side of recruitment which really worked a treat in that period of time. But I think for every club it's inevitable that these changes and these sort of refreshes need to be made, almost certainly from a personal point of view and a club point of view, just to ensure that things don't become not stale, but that there's always fresh voices and that they're always trying to keep ahead of the game, and that's the big challenge for Liverpool now, I think.
All right, fascinating stuff. Well, next up, let's leave the world of the Premier League and head off to the World Cup qualifiers.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite according to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which might just come in handy when Brighton start being Brighton again and go back to outperforming their XG and not winning. Pre-match bet builders only. Get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Max free bet £10. Excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. It's over 18s only. And please, gamble responsibly.
All right then, listener. You stay with us this far. Here we go. Let's get on to those World Cup qualifiers. Thursday night, the final decisive round of matches begins. For the winners, automatic spots at the next World Cup. For the losers, the consolation of a place on the moral high ground from which they can pretend not to watch this morally challenging tournament next winter. Now, Germany and Denmark are already booked for Qatar. Among the sides sweating their places are Spain and Italy. Also Netherlands, Croatia, Russia and Portugal. So for a quick roundup of the matches that matter, let's have some vibes, producer Charlie. Spain are 2 points behind Sweden. They face each other on Sunday, but not before on Thursday the Swedes visit Georgia and Spain go to Greece. On Friday, England face Albania. Scotland travel to Moldova. A win will see them qualify for a playoff. While in Rome, it's Italy-Switzerland, with the two teams currently level on points. It's a spareggio. Saturday, drama in Group G, where three teams can make top spot. Netherlands, only 2 points ahead of Norway, who are 2 points above Turkey. The Dutch head to Montenegro, while their Scando rivals host Latvia and Turkey host Gibraltar. Sunday is possibly the most dramatic day of all. First off, Croatia face Russia. The Russians 2 points clear of Zlatko Dalic's side, so it should be quite an atmosphere in Split. Then Sunday evening, Portugal face Serbia. Cristiano Ronaldo trying to qualify for his fifth World Cup. Portugal, though, trailing Serbia by 1 point, but they play at Ireland on Thursday. While Sunday night in Seville, it's that aforementioned Spain against Sweden. Sweden, now with the 40-year-old Zlatan Ibrahimovic back in their squad, in the same Sevilla stadium where these two teams drew 0-0 in June at Euro 2020. Crikey. Wow. Exactly 4 years ago, remember? Who was it who ousted Italy in the playoffs to qualify for the 2018 World Cup? Colin, it was Sweden. How worried are they in Spain?
Yeah, Spain's situation is so precarious at the minute. Obviously, they have these two matches coming up against the two teams who they have stumbled against in the group. And Spain have stumbled against Sweden, obviously, in the Euros as well. And they really, I think, need to realistically win both of these matches. And they need to do it without a host of star players, especially in attack. There's no Ansu Fati, there's no Ferran Torres, there's no Gerard Moreno, there's no Mikel Oyarzabal. They're probably their four standout attacking players, and there's not a lot of pressure on Alvaro Morata to once again to step up and to really put his daughters behind him. And Morata has had such a tough time with the Spanish crowd, and I think often this is how it's portrayed in the media, that it's almost like this constant drama going on, where he has these incredible highs and these terrible lows, where he's either responsible for a penalty miss or for a glaring miss from point blank range, or he scores this fantastic goal to keep his team in the tournament. So this is a really big challenge for Luis Enrique. It's a really big challenge for Spain. And like, we've seen them in the Euros, whereby they reached the semi-finals and were outstanding against Italy, and then again in the Nations League, where they enjoy playing these big teams. But it's the teams like Greece, like the teams like Sweden, who are happy to not have the ball, to soak up pressure and to hit them on the counter-attack. And Sweden's star player is Alexander Isak, who Spanish fans know all about through his exploits with Real Sociedad this season. And he is an absolutely outstanding player, an outstanding prospect, and they're really going to need to know how to defend against him on the counter-attack, especially.
In light of what you were saying there, the previous clash with the Greeks, who they'll be facing on Thursday at home, was a 1-1 draw. Spain with 80% possession, Greece scoring with their only shot of the entire game. Crikey. That same night, Sweden travelled to Georgia. You could even see the Swedes going out of sight before we even get to Sunday's game. Extraordinary. A World Cup without Spain, if they didn't get through a playoff. Rory.
Yeah, I think the funny thing is, it's really built to a really nice kind of conclusion, this set of World Cup qualifiers. Just, I mean, obviously, apart from England's group, where they'll beat Albania and qualify, there's kind of interest everywhere, really, isn't there? That, you know, the Serbia playing Portugal is fascinating, although by that stage, the Portuguese should really be in a position where a draw will take them through. But still, there is that possibility that Portugal end up in the playoffs. Italy facing Switzerland is fascinating. But the one that really has caught my eye for the last month is that Dutch, Norway, Turkey group. Because they've all got relatively winnable games in this week's fixtures. They should all really win. And then next week, the Norwegians go to Amsterdam. And it may well be that that's a straight shootout for top spot. The Norwegians haven't been to a major tournament for 20 years. They've got this brilliant sort of coming generation with the one star player who's injured. And, you know, they would have been going to Amsterdam, I think, thinking they could maybe win if Haaland was there. But without him, it suddenly becomes a lot more challenging. So I think that is the group where it feels like there's the most riding on it. Just look, if the Italians stumble, James might not say it like this, but if the Italians stumble against Switzerland, they'll get a playoff and there's a decent chance they'll get through. Same with the Spanish, really. The Spanish would back themselves against pretty much anybody, I guess, apart from Italy, in a playoff. But with the Norwegians, they could conceivably finish third and not get a playoff at all, because the Turks should overtake them. So that whole group is incredibly precariously balanced, and it is fascinating, which is not something you often say about international football. It's almost like it's worth going through the 18 months of sheer boredom to get to this one set of fixtures.
But we've had so many highs along the way, Rory. I have to say, regarding playoffs, I kind of was assuming myself that the big teams would go through, but they're one-legged playoffs. And if you take the example of Spain, to take one, a team that only drew against the Greeks, a team that hasn't beaten Sweden in any of its last three meetings with them, a team that fails to beat teams that they should beat necessarily in single one-off matches. So all the bets are off. Let's talk then about Italy-Switzerland. They meet at the Stadio Olimpico in Rome on Friday. They are level on points at the top of Group C. They've both got plenty of absentees. The last five meetings, James, four of them have been drawn.
Historically, it's a tight game, although they should have won the reverse fixture in September. Jorginho missed a penalty. And, you know, obviously when they last met at the Stadio Olimpico, they beat them 3-0. Things have changed since then. Switzerland have changed their manager. Petkovic is gone. And they've got a number of absentees themselves because Italy go into this game pretty depleted. But have so much strength and depth that even if Angelo Ogbonna was fit, but Ogbonna wouldn't be in the squad. And I think Ogbonna's had some grievances about that. I felt he should have been in contention for the Euro squad and presumably for September and October as well. Chiellini dropped out today, but then again, Chiellini got injured after, what, 5-10 minutes of the Switzerland game, and Acerbi came in for him and did pretty well. Verratti was missing when they played in the Euros. He's missing again tonight. It didn't really matter then, because what were people crying for? More Locatelli, because Locatelli scored twice against the Swiss. Immobile's fit, but again, you know, he was kind of venting before he suffered his injury on Wednesday, because he was put up to the media on Tuesday. So, you know, there are people who don't think he's any good, even though he's won the Golden Shoe, even though he's, you know, sort of been top scorer in Italy three times. I think only Gunnar Nordahl has actually done that more. They'll find it. I think the thing that they have in their favour compared with, you know, when they didn't qualify for the World Cup last time around, was that they had a manager who was incapable of managing big moments in Giampiero Ventura, and incapable of managing big players. And certainly at the Euros in the summer, I think one of the things that people around Mancini said that was very good about him was how he kept his composure under pressure. For example, halftime against England, you know, you could have said in the final, for example, could say, right, we need to change formation, we need to make some substitutions, and instead made a couple of adjustments, said play the same way, and didn't make any substitutions until, what, after the hour mark. And by that time, they were back in control with possession. Crowd got demoralised, blah, blah, blah. So I think that's in their favour. But obviously it is, you know, it's a high stakes, right. It's a high stakes game, so...
Just like it was 4 years ago against the Swedes at San Siro. And of course, if it does go wrong, it'll come down to those final matches. So when the Swiss will be at home to Bulgaria and Italy travel to Belfast.
I just think that for Italy, and obviously we know what they're about and being European champions, but Switzerland are just such a difficult team to play against. They are so consistent. They are always good. They're rarely great, but they are just such a difficult team to beat. And they are a team who are who were the highest second seeds in this qualification system. And I think they're unlucky that they're not top seeds, and the fact that they've been Nations League finalists. They're regulars in the knockout stages of European competition and World Cups. And they're only really ever eliminated on penalties. And this is a team who are going to be really difficult, even without star players. And at the Euros, they were without Granit Xhaka against Spain, and they were down to 10 men in that game. And they could have won on the penalty shootout. So it's a really huge challenge for Italy. But I would imagine that Italy, who then go to Belfast on the final match day, they should win that game. Northern Ireland are not in good form. They're in a bit of a transitional phase. They haven't won a home game in 9 matches, and their 2 home games in this group have ended 0-0. So they just don't create enough scoring opportunities. They don't have a natural goal scorer within the squad, and it's a major difficulty. Of course, this is a game that could suit them in terms of they will sit back and they will be relatively well defensively drilled. But if Italy go for this, if Italy need to win this game, I think Italy will win this game. It won't be high scoring, but I think they'll get the job done.
Although the Swiss may fancy their chances at home to Bulgaria. Crikey. Rory, Republic and the home nations. Colin mentioning Northern Ireland there. They're out of it. Republic are out to Scotland. Victory at Moldova will secure a playoff place. Otherwise, it might go down to a nail-biting night at Hampden on Monday against group winners Denmark. Wales, I believe, are pretty much sorted out off the back of their Nations League performance in terms of a playoff. And England, you're confident that they won't lose on Friday night, which might see Poland topping the group ahead of the final round of matches and, oh my goodness, disaster.
Yeah, I think it's relatively comfortable for England. There is, in a sense, I suppose it's quite nice for an England qualification process that in the last 2 games there is some sort of jeopardy. That feels like it's a good thing, really. I'm sure kind of ardent England fans wouldn't agree, but it would feel like a waste of everybody's time from an English perspective if they were to, if these were two total dead rubbers and they were just trying to rubber stamping England's presence. So it's nice there's some sort of jeopardy, but I don't think there's any real jeopardy. The Scots, yeah, a win does them in Moldova, and I would expect that to happen. Although obviously with Scotland, the golden rule is never expect anything. The problem that they will have, and you know, reaching a playoff place is fantastic for them, but the caliber of teams they're likely to come up against in the playoffs, which as you quite rightly say, are one-legged affairs, that means that qualification for the actual World Cup is still quite a long way off. Mm. But it's, yeah, they should at least get to put themselves in that slightly unfairly weighted lottery.
The draw for the slightly unfairly weighted lottery will be made on the 26th of November in Switzerland.
I was just going to mention the Portugal group, because I think this has actually been the most interesting of all the groups. I think it's the group that's had the most narratives, because right throughout it, you obviously had Cristiano Ronaldo breaking the international goal scoring record in that dramatic fashion against the Republic of Ireland. But then you've also had the Republic of Ireland situation with the Stephen Kenny position, and he's almost had a mini revival now after the poor results against Azerbaijan and Luxembourg. And Luxembourg, who are probably the most improved European nation in the past 10 or 15 years, whereby they now have two players who are regular starters in the Champions League group stages. But the nation who are most interested in that are Serbia, who have missed out on each of the last two European Championships, despite it being expanded to 24 nations. So this is a group of players who are extremely talented. They've got a lot of players at top clubs, and they've got big ambitions, I suppose, and this is a nation who should be regularly in these tournaments. But it was that Nikola Milenkovic sort of freak own goal in Dublin against the Republic of Ireland that cost them the victory, cost them 2 points, and that could end up costing them the automatic place in this group. And obviously this is going to go down to the wire with the late game against Portugal, but the Serbia are just such a strange team that they have so much individual talent, but they've never really been able to work it out as a sort of functioning unit.
Right. They're 1 point ahead, I believe, of Portugal. But Portugal have the game in hand Thursday away to the Republic of Ireland. Huge on Sunday night. Brilliant. All right. Well, that's how exciting the international weekend is. Very. Very shortly, we're going to be hearing about far and away the best football team on the planet. And, also content from content. But first, let's get some odds from Paddy Power's Carl Monaghan and Pretty Sir Charlie.
Hello listener, happy November international break to you. There's all sorts of delights for us with the conclusion of the World Cup qualifiers, and it's possible that the European champions might have to go through the lottery of the playoffs. We've got Italy versus Switzerland, gelato versus chocolate, pasta versus fondue. Sorry, I missed breakfast. Carl, what's going to happen on the pitch in Rome on Friday night?
I've never tried fondue, Charlie, but I have this ambition to stick my face in a big bowl of it. Like Winnie the Pooh attacking a hive of sweet, sweet honey. Where were we, Charlie? Rome on Friday night. Yes, Italy playing host to the Swiss in Group C. Now, both teams are level on points with two games to play, so the playoffs route a very real possibility, like you say, Charlie, if Italy don't deliver over the next few days. The Paddy Power trainers are 1-9, though, about Italy to win the group. Last time the sides met, it was a scoreless draw, but the Azzurri coach, Roberto Mancini, has the majority of his Euro 2020 winning lieutenants fit and available to call upon, while the Swiss are without one of their most influential players in the form of Arsenal bad boy Granit Xhaka, and still are guilty of over-relying on the pint-sized assassin Shaqiri to score their goals. Price-wise, Italy are no surprise the favourites at 8-15 to win this one. The draw is 11-4, and the Swiss are 5-1.
Meanwhile, Spain have two massive games between now and Monday morning that will decide their fate. Greece on Thursday, Sweden on Sunday. Carl, are we looking at two wins out of two for Luis Enrique's men? Or, shock horror, two defeats out of two?
Well, Spain are 4-11 to win the group, but Sweden at 15-8 to win Group A is not a terrible price either, Charlie, as the Scandinavians have been brilliant so far in this campaign with 5 wins from 6, including beating Spain earlier in the group in Stockholm back in September. But first up on Thursday for Spain, like you point out, is Greece. The Greeks are 8-1 to win the game. The draw is 130, and a Spanish win is 2-5. The pressure will be on coach Luis Enrique, as the Swedes will be expected to get 3 points against Georgia on the same night. Remember, listeners, Spain have not failed to qualify for a major tournament since 1992. So then Sunday, they play host to Sweden and are odds-on favourites to win at 3-10. The draw is 15-4, and the visitors are rather big, I think, at 17-2. Depending on what happens in Greece Thursday night, Charlie, Luis Enrique's men may find themselves in a nervy, cagey encounter with one of the best Swedish units we've seen for a while. But it's sit back and enjoy the movie and popcorn for the neutrals, Charlie. So let the games begin.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply when the fun stop. Match day 3 in the Women's Champions League took place Tuesday and Wednesday. Chelsea 7-0 winners in Sevilla on Tuesday. Woof. Nice way to warm up for their meeting with rivals Manchester City in the WSL on Sunday. A WSL weekend which also features a North London derby Saturday lunchtime. You can hear much more about that in the Offside Rule podcast. I'm sure they'll find time to talk about Barcelona. What did they do on Wednesday night, Rory?
They won 4-0, which has taken their goals scored this season to 64 and their goals conceded to 3. Well, it's not taking their goals conceded to 3. They didn't concede any goals. They are, by some distance at the moment, probably the most dominant football team on the planet, Barcelona Femení. They are incredible. I went to see them, was in Barcelona for the Dinamo Kiev game and went to speak to a few people around the women's team. And what I found really surprising, the two things that really stood out, one is that their coach is genuinely convinced they haven't scored enough goals, which initially I thought was just like a coach being like very publicly a coach and saying kind of, oh, no, it's not good enough, we can always get better, when very clearly you can't get better. But he genuinely meant it. He says that they kind of, they've created more than 200 opportunities and he doesn't understand why they haven't converted more. And I kind of said, well, the goalkeeper's allowed to make saves. And he sort of said, yeah, but what about the ones that go wide? And it's just, I mean, I can't imagine being that driven or ambitious. And the other thing actually that I thought was fascinating was I spoke to Marta Torrejón, who's I think 31 now. She's been there 8 years. She said that she'd never really been inside like a professional gym until she was in her mid-20s, because she started her career when women's football in Spain was almost entirely amateur. Whereas now, girls who are kind of 12, 13 are going into a professional environment and training. And her view was that the talent level is probably the same, but the preparation they're getting is of such a high level now compared to what she experienced, that they are already, that they'll be hitting the first team substantially further ahead than she was when she did. And their view is that this is just the start of how good Barcelona Femení can be, which, given how good they are, is probably mildly worrying for everybody else.
Mm. Well, indeed. You've got a piece up handily, Rory, about Barcelona Femení at the moment. Is that right?
I do indeed, yeah. Went out on Wednesday.
Oh, lovely stuff. Lovely stuff. You've also had another one recently, which I enjoyed, talking about the rise of, well, to borrow your headline, when soccer is just the storyline. This was Rory's intro. When Hollywood has arrived at Wrexham, Peter Crouch is trying to reproduce Sunderland Till I Die at Dulwich Hamlet. What happens when a team becomes a stage for a documentary? What comes first, the content or the club? The medium is the massage, you could have gone with for a lot of
that. That would have been better. Yeah, and funnily enough, the more emerged after we published it. Robbie Savage, I think, has done one at Macclesfield,
yes,
which I didn't know about. Which is
lucky
just
you.
That's just bad journalism. Me, not him. I'm sure it's very good. I think it's available now to watch, in fact.
It is. There's memes from it already.
That is not surprising. Right. But there are quite a lot of these projects in the work. The people will have probably seen the ones at Salford. I think Fleetwood made one. There was kind of a retrospective QPR one, a retrospective Crystal Palace one. Obviously, there's the All or Nothing series. There was Leeds, Make Us Dream, was that called? I think what's different is that you are getting more and more production companies who are effectively buying the clubs, that they are clearly looking at, certainly in the case of Crouch and Dulwich Hamlet, the people bankrolling the documentary looked at the success of Sunderland Till I Die and thought, right, let's do that. And I guess as part of their kind of production expenses, they thought, well, we need someone to... There need to be states in a documentary. Both you and James work in television much more than I do. You'll know that. There have to be states, and the state there is that Crouch is on the board at Dulwich Hamlet. I don't really know why he has to be on the board at Dulwich Hamlet. It doesn't really make any sense for him to be on the board. You then have the example of Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney at Wrexham, who've been fairly upfront about the fact that they have bought the club to make a documentary. Hmm. And there's a couple of examples in Italy as well, that North Sixth Group, who are an American investment firm, bought Campobasso, who were in Serie D 2 years ago, and they've got them promoted to Serie C. That's already been made into a documentary for a YouTube channel. And they are now owners of Astley, who basically seem to want them to do the same thing. And I kind of went into the piece thinking this is clearly bad, that there's kind of a twin risk. One is that for the documentary to be interesting, you need to create tension within the club. And that's not what is good for a club. And the other thing, and I think this is the thing that has not yet been satisfactorily answered at Wrexham, what happens when the documentary has finished?
Mm.
Where does the club go then? But speaking to people involved, particularly Matt Rosetta, who's the chairman of Campobasso and Astley, his view is, and I think it has a lot of sense, even if it might offend your kind of traditionalist fan, is that ultimately for clubs like that, how are you meant to increase your revenues? Because you're not going to sell TV rights, just, you know, Astley a Serie B. There won't be a lot of money in the TV rights for Serie B. Sponsorship deals are limited because there aren't any TV rights, and you know you're not going to get big companies coming to you and paying you a lot of money to be on your shirts or whatever. You can increase ticket sales, and the only revenue stream available really is content. And his view certainly is that the two things can run symbiotically, that you sell the content, that brings more revenue into the club, that improves the club. And I think in a kind of coldly logical sense, that works. The issue is, I think, that thing about what happens if the documentary comes first. What does that mean for the club, both in the here and now, in terms of kind of what decisions are being made and what choices are being made, but also what happens afterwards, because there is Reynolds and McElhenney have sold two seasons of Welcome to Wrexham to FX in the States.
Right.
If they're the only two seasons, what do they pull out? What happens
and then,
there?
And then you make a documentary about the collapse of Wrexham after Reynolds and McElhenney move on. I mean, that's the thing. I, in a sense, it's surprising that it's taken people to this long to spot the fact that football is just extraordinary gift that keeps on giving in terms of narrative. I mean, you could hire an entire city worth of writers and they wouldn't come up with half the stuff that the Premier League alone comes up with week in, week out. And this is how people like us make podcasts all the time and hopefully keep them relatively interesting. But it is an important distinction that you make between people who are simply reporting, as say Sunderland Till I Die did, and people who are actively making the fact that they are making a documentary the theme of the documentary, which is, well, I think, what's happening at Wrexham.
It changes you from observer to participant.
Mm.
And that is a really fundamental difference. And I think that's where the risk is. Ultimately, I think there's a limit to how many documentaries about struggling football teams set in post-industrial Britain that people can possibly consume. But you could feasibly make Sunderland Till I Die at quite a lot of clubs, to be honest, because, all right, not everyone's had the kind of the collapse of Sunderland, but that, you know, a lot of the themes will be the same. But it's interesting that does seem to have had a real influence on this this push. I mean, Rob McElhenney, I think, has admitted that he watched Sunderland Till I Die in the first lockdown, and then called the person who's now, there was a piece in The Athletic to do your own advertising for you, the guy who's now chief exec, I think, at Wrexham, and called him and said, right, let's do this. Let's find a club to buy and make a documentary. That was what inspired him. The whole Crouch project at Hamlet is inspired by Sunderland Till I Die. There is a desire to, as always in television, people like them, let's make more of them. But the difference is that no one at Sunderland Till I Die had any control on what actually happened. They were simply, they were reporting it and recording it. It's different when you effectively are the club. You are both the subject and the director.
It does sort of feed into this to the entire structure of football, whereby every club has people who are invested in it for all sorts of reasons, of course, but a lot of the reasons are not to achieve sporting success, and you know, a lot of the reasons are purely based on their own personal greed, I suppose is the best way of putting it. So this is obviously different. It's obviously something that does raise questions and that does sort of open a kind of unexplored chapter in terms of where this will go. But I don't think that this is the biggest issue with ownership across football. And I think that the sport in itself has, it went down a rabbit hole long ago in terms of this. And there's probably no way back in the near future. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. And I think the Wrexham example is a really good one of two people who've come in as almost total aliens, I suppose, in terms of the situation of Wrexham Football Club, yet they do come across so genuinely. Of course, they do have an acting background, but they really do seem to enjoy participating within the club and learning about the club, the area, and the fans. And I think there's something quite wholesome about that. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But football ownership in general is definitely not a clear cut issue, and there's probably no moral stance to be had on it as things stand.
It does make you worry though that historic clubs like AFC Richmond are in some way getting hijacked by these productions for, I don't know, whatever dramatic ends they have in mind. Anyway, very good. That brings us to the end of today's show. Monday, we return with many, if not all, of the verdicts from that massive weekend of international qualifying matches. So do join us for that, listener. For now, though, it's many, many thanks to Colin, to James, and to Rory, and to producer Charlie, and you too, listener. Have a great weekend, and we'll catch up with you Monday.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.